and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Malu apa bosku, a simple three-word catchphrase that underpinned the 2019 social media campaign that sought to regain Najib Razak's political mileage against the backdrop of the 1MDB-related trials. Now, despite whatever his detractors say, the campaign was undeniably a success at the time. It was even said to be behind one of the factors behind Barisan Nasional's victory in some of the 2019 by-elections, namely in Cameron Highlands and Semenye. Now today on the show, we're going to take stock of what the Malu Apa Bosku campaign can teach us about the way we as a society respond to the cult of personality in Malaysian politics. Dr. Benjamin Low joins me now. He's a senior lecturer at the University of Taylor's University at the School of Media and Communications. He is the lead author of the recently published journal article titled "Shame and Shamelessness: The Changing Discourses in Najib Razak's Social Media Campaign." Ben, thank you so much for joining me on the show. I mean, what a fascinating topic. I personally had a thought a couple of years ago. I thought, what a curious and irrational phenomenon this Malu Apa Bosku campaign, how the way it gained so much traction. How did you come about it? What was it like for you? What made you want to study this as from a perspective of political communication and from a social media narrative?
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me on your show. This campaign definitely was very, very interesting. And that's why me and my two other authors, you have Dr. Vilachini Somia and also Sarah Ali, both from UM, and we sort of like chanced upon this campaign. And the thing is, political campaigns on social media are not new in Malaysia. We tend to see them quite a bit, but they always tend to follow a very sort of like a limited or very fixed kind of formula. It's often going to just be an extension of their regular political communication, which is, you know, these are the policies that they're working on, this is the platforms they are trying to present to the people. And sometimes you have this really very very forced and awkward kind of like personal humanizing kind of post where they talk about this is what I'm doing on my everyday life, that kind of thing. They always seem overly engineered. And for the most part, people have sort of accepted it as well. But the thing about Malu Apa was that it was a different kind of campaign. And this is where our paper sort of like unpacks that, you know, the way they sort of like takes control of shame in a very, very different way than what we come to expect in our politics, especially, you know, you mentioned just now about how when people look at Malu Apa Bosku's success, the campaign success, we always think about how is it that people are so irrational. But when you how political communication works, it really is focusing on the irrational, the emotional aspect as well. And this is where the campaign was really very, very focused in that aspect as well.
Very, very emotional. I think quite interesting. Okay, let's kind of rewind back and then think about the origins of the Malu Apa Bosku campaign. Can you refresh our memories how it started, how this three-word catchphrase actually came about?
Okay, so the campaign was sort of like conceived and pretty much started right at the start of 2019 in January. And again, this was definitely something that was strategized as a result of a very, very disastrous sort of like 6 months before that, you know. Basically, Najib was probably at his lowest political point. Well, technically now he's at his lowest, but at that point, that was a very, very low point for him. You know, he had lost general elections, his party was out of power, he had to shamefully resign. And for the most part, he was trying to sort of like keep himself in the political limelight, even though there were a lot of these sort of like seizures, there were a lot of these cases being brought up against him. And he was trying to sort of like make a name for himself on social media to a certain aspect. You know, he would be engaging in a lot of like current topics and doing it in a very sort of like professional manner as well. But the point that really sort of like made him withdraw from the public eye was that incredibly disastrous interview that he did with Al Jazeera. That was really the point where he lost his cool, he lost his composure, and this is not a person that was once a prime minister of the country. The way he behaved was incredibly disgraceful to a certain extent. And so he sort of kept himself under the covers for like the next 4 months, and then Malu Apa came about. And the start of Malu Apa Bosku was quite interesting. You know, he basically showed up at this sort of meet and greet event in I think it was in KL, I can't remember. And basically he wore a hoodie, he wore jeans, he wore like sneakers, and then he sat on top of like, you know, a Honda Cup type style motorcycle, which is synonymous with the colloquially called the Kapchai here, and very synonymous with the Mat Rempit community. And he basically took that infamous picture where he's sort of like sitting on it and looking behind, and then the tagline Malu Apa Bosku comes on. And that's sort of like the way for him to sort of like change his entire image to that. So instead of focusing on him being this sort of like political statesman, he's now basically a man of the people. You know, he's sort of like, he's dressing up in very working class type of clothing. And he's, again, the Kapchai is basically the symbol of, you know, the urban Malay youth in this country and their status as low wage earners, essentially. You know, and again, we'll talk more about how that sort of like, he tries to link his own political downfall with their sort of like working class challenges as well.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, we'll come to that. I do want to focus on the Malu Apa Bosku phrase, because it's not something I had heard of before he coined it as a catchphrase. Now, the use of the term kind of Bosku at face value seems to be an authority figure, a leadership figure, the Bosku. But there are those who point out that this is actually a lexicon from Sabah youth, if I'm not mistaken, term of endearment. So what does it reflect, the use of this Apa Malu Bosku? Where did it come from? And what does it mean?
All right. So Apa Malu Bosku, literally translated, would be why the shame, my boss. That's a literal translation. But of course, as you mentioned, Bosku is a term that, again, this is where Najib appropriated this term from Sabah itself. It's not a term that people here in Peninsula Malaysia regularly use. I think for a lot of people, we've never heard it. But these days, you can regularly see people use Bosku in just about anything. You know, you can buy it on T-shirts and caps and whatnot. And that's sort of like the impact of his campaign has had. He's sort of taken this very localized term and made it national in that sense. But the way that he sort of appropriated it also was intentional. It wasn't just that, oh, this is a catchy term that he wanted to use, but it was a term that was used in Sabah. And this is where sort of like I work with my collaborator, Dr. Vilashini, who does a lot of work on Sabah in particular. But we also sort of like draw upon the works of Dr. Tracy Tangit, who spoke quite a bit about this aspect, about how the term Bosku is actually used in Sabah itself. You know, they're used primarily by two different communities. Basically, they're either going to be laborers, essentially, who they may or may not be foreign laborers or just local laborers, but often the term Bosku is used as a way of trying to sort of show that some sort of deference towards your immediate boss. So that there is some sort of hierarchy being presented there, but it's also presented in a way whereby you show that you're trying to sort of like even out the hierarchical differences between the two. It's like, as you mentioned, it's a term of endearment. And it's also done in a way to sort of like make sure that the relationship is cordial and it's friendly. There is mutual respect as well. And I think Najib, in adopting that phrase, has sort of like also sort of like tried to make it seem as though he was a former sort of like boss of the country and everybody was sort of like his underlings. And therefore, even though he has done all of these things, so like he's been in a state of disgrace. And again, the way that he sort of like takes on shame is that he uses it in a way that is very unlike any other politician. You know, traditionally, this is something that, and this is not just unique to Najib, but you know, in a lot of the other different places, a lot of far right leaders are reappropriating or sort of like using shame in a certain way that will actually advance their political campaigns. The way that political shame works in politics is that shame is often used as the ultimate tool to keep politicians accountable. So the idea here is that you want to make sure that the politician always projects this image that they are, you know, they have good character, they are family people, they represent like the ideal family values and whatnot. And usually anything that can shatter that illusion, even though they're not necessarily illegal and whatnot, can actually result in them either forcing to sort of like apologize and basically retreat from the public eye, that's, and resign and whatnot. So that's usually the way that shame is often used. And it's a very effective tool. You know, we've seen it a lot in Malaysia, which is why you see, you know, a lot of like sex scandals, sex tapes tend to be a way in which you try to force politicians to either who have stepped out of line or to force them to follow like suit as well. But with Najib, you know, we had all these corruption cases and whatnot. And he instead was using the shame, and instead of saying that, you know, I admit that I did all these things wrong, he just adopts this very sort of like generic, sort of like apologetic tone that I am in a shameful position. I have done some mistakes. I've done all these things wrong. And again, he never clarifies what those mistakes were. But for the most part, the main one he tries to draw it with the rest of his followers is this idea that he lost the election. And the reason he lost the election, and he draws comparisons with regular people, voters in that sense. He basically says that, you know, PH1, because they had all these grandiose lies, their propaganda machine was incredibly powerful, it was sophisticated, and I was powerless to stop it. And I understand that I lost the election because they were so powerful, and I also understand that you, the regular people, but do not worry, we're both in the same boat. We both suffered the consequences, and it's not our fault. Do not have any shame for this, and therefore let us move forward. And that's a very, very resonating cry that pretty much was the huge rallying cry that really spoke to the masses, essentially. And that was why all of these things really worked together. And that's the crux of what our paper was really looking at.
Fascinating, because of the different ways he maybe subverted the shame or misappropriated shame. Not very unexpected, I have to say. Can I ask you to break it down for me? When you say that he succeeded in creating this persona of the everyday man, what did that happen? How did the 180-degree turn happen from a elite political lineage and, you know, privileged lifestyle? We would refer to him as Golongan Kayangan, right? To refashioning himself as an everyday man, as flirting with rumpet culture, as, you know, someone who is grassroots and understands the realities and pains of young working class men. And he got so much celebrity for it. I'm trying to understand, how was it so effective? How did it not come across as cosplay or inauthentic, as so many other types of campaigns do?
Well, I think it was really in the way that he presented the language, you know. So Malu Apa Bosku, the campaign in itself, was very, very focused. So the way that we ran our study was that we only looked at any of his posts, specifically on Facebook. His entire campaign was primarily focused on Facebook. I think there was some dabbling in Twitter, but when that didn't get traction, they sort of abandoned it. So it was pretty much exclusively on Facebook. And a lot of this very campaign messaging was focused on the use of the hashtag or the term Malu Apa Bosku very, very specifically. And this is actually a very, very important point, because if you notice the way that Najib's social media accounts was being managed during that period, you would see that he would basically be posting daily updates, you know, it was either on his court cases or any of like any issues that affected like the PH government, any way that he could sort of attack the PH government or support BN on the side and things like that. So that was sort of like the main thing. So his account was very, very careful, was very active in that sense. But Malu Apa Bosku posts that he made, not other people were doing, were a lot more measured. They will often come like once a week, maybe twice a week. It was very, very little in comparison. And the messaging was divided. Again, our paper breaks it down into, there's different ways in which he tried to sort of like build this sort of like resonance towards the people. You know, there were some, he had certain posts where he just focused on talking about, you know, humanizing himself, which actually were the ones that actually were that gathered the most traction from people. And unlike other politicians who tend to, whenever they do humanizing posts, it's always going to be presented in a way whereby he's doing a regular everyday thing, but they will always have some sort of political messaging. It's always a very long-winded post together. It's kind of like, you know, when you have some politicians from the previous government that would like wear like food rider delivery shirts or do menial work, the hand thing. And then they would have like a long post to describe, they understand the struggle. So that he did none of that. He basically just had like, I think the one that really had the most traction was that one photo that he put up on Valentine's Day. He just put a picture of himself, very simple picture, and just said that, Malaysia, be my, I would love for you to be my Valentine. Very simple picture, very simple, straightforward. And that really, people really liked it. And that really garnered a lot of sort of like engagement. And another thing was that he always did was that he made a lot of posts that really talked about how, and this was where the campaign sort of built up this idea that he was trying to link himself to the Mat Rempit community. And he always argued that. And again, this is actually a very good point that he made as well. You know, the Mat Rempit community in Malaysia is often painted with very, very broad strokes of stereotypes. This idea that this is a community that is always seen as having the stigma of being unambitious. They are always seen as being possibly lazy because they don't have proper careers. You know, being a delivery rider or a dispatch rider is not seen as a legitimate career choice. And these youth are seen as just not wanting to progress beyond that as well. And he makes the same argument that, yes, the migrant community are always misunderstood. They're always targeted by people. They're always put down. like me, I've also been in that situation. All these charges are trumped. I was sort of like painted to be the bad guy when actually I didn't do any of these things, or there's all these misconceptions again. And that was sort of like the start of it. And from that, it started to build momentum based on that as well. So yeah, and so he did all of that. And the third type of post that he tended to put up was basically, that he would always show himself, you know, attending all these like public events, and there would just be crowds of people going to see that as well. Now, in Malaysia, you know, we have been in our political situation in Malaysia in social media is that, you know, it's full of cyber troopers, it's full of these machais who are presenting to other people and whatnot. So you can't really trust the numbers whenever you see engagement. But when you see physical people attending these things, that becomes a little bit more difficult to refute in that sense. And his campaign leveraged that quite a bit, especially during by-election campaigns, where whenever he would go, there will be huge crowds awaiting him and things like that.
So, Ben, just to quickly interrupt you, the online presence, so how much of the social media response to the Malu Apa Bosku campaign was authentic, was organic, as opposed to, say, manufactured influence or coordinated influence, inauthentic behaviors? Because when you talk about real life crowds, how does that translate from online to offline?
To be honest, and I think this is something that I think anybody who studies this space will tell you, we will never know. We do not have any accurate measures of doing it, of measuring it. We can probably guess, basically, there is like a rough idea that maybe depending on which party is involved, which machinery is involved in sort of providing all of this information, you have a sense of where things are going to go. But in online space, it's really anybody's guess. But just to give you a sense of it, I think for a lot of Malu Apa Bosku campaigns, sort of like posts, especially the ones that were just about personalizing Najib himself, they tended to get at least like 100,000 likes at the very minimum. And again, that's a very good figure. But again, we don't know how much of that is real or not. Again, even in the physical sense, it's very hard to tell whether or not these people were paid to be there or not. But again, you know, the idea here is that for the average person that sees it, you know, when you see huge crowds gathering around, like, you also can make the argument that this is a person that's under the gun. He's had many property seizures being sort of like taken away, confiscated away from him as well. How much money would he still have? I mean, the other people would argue that he probably still has a lot tucked away somewhere as well. But again, these things are difficult to refute if you see them over and over again, essentially. Mm. So,
part of his post, and you talked about how it felt authentic and simple and differed in a way from. Differed from the other social media campaigns that other politicians do. One of the things that struck me was the way he would troll other politicians. I'm thinking of that very famous Super Ring post where he had posted it right after Tun Dr. Mahathir was removed as Bersatu Prime Minister in 2020, I think, just before the Sheraton move. So he's trolling, and that becomes this way to distract and to divert the narrative away from himself. But memes like that, I mean, it sparked memes, but memes like that also solidify this kind of tribal bond, right? So that builds persuasion online. How do you see him leading this meme-led political discourse of Najib Razak as the troll?
So I'm just going to go back to, because technically the Malu Apa Bosku campaign that we studied, I think, was only running for about a year, maximum 1 year. It was pretty much only for 2019. After 2019, a lot of that Malu Apa Bosku specific messaging was pretty much gone already. He did, again, that's why we believe that it was a team that was running it. They were probably paid to run it for like 9 to 9 months to about a year. And so at the end of 2019, their work had been done, and they were just sort of like, okay, we already have that base of support, and that's how we can go. But he did sort of like do certain trolling as well. And the trolling that he did was actually quite interesting. And again, something that we don't usually see. And I think you mentioned just about how he sort of like focused on humanizing himself. One of the key things that Najib did in his campaign to humanize himself that worked very, very well was that he had the ability to be self-deprecating in all his posts. Most of our politicians, again, Malaysian politics, up until very recently, it has been dominated by a lot of, it's very hyper-masculine, it's full of bravado, you know, this whole idea that, you know, politicians know best. You know, they have the people's mandate, and therefore they can do no wrong. They have all the best experts at their disposal, and they you will rarely ever see politicians apologize. And even if they do apologize, it's always going to be highly qualified. It's going to there's going to be a myriad of excuses that sort of like insulates them from any personal responsibility in that sense. And if they do take the actual responsibility, that means that this politician is on their way out. They're going to resign, and they're just going to fade away from the public eye as a result of that. But here you have Najib with an unprecedented number of, you know, corruption cases levied charges against him. And here he is sort of like just sort of like saying that, okay, I'm sorry that I was not better. I'm only human. And at the same time, he also sort of like, and again, when you sort of like take on that supposed shame, and rather than sort of like just disappearing, which is what you're expected to do, he sort of remained in the spotlight. And that confused everybody else as well. And when I say self-deprecating, one of the things that he did very, very well was there was at one point in 2019, there were these there was one of those usual scandals about how some politician faked their education credentials. And so one of the questions that came up to Najib was that, did he fake his degree? It's the usual kind of, like, you know, random calls, you know, not rooted in evidence, but it ended up at his doorstep. And he used that moment to do something very, very interesting. He basically posted a picture of himself at his graduation party, and it was not a very flattering photo. It was an old photo, and it was a candid photo, so he wasn't prepared for it. And he basically said that, you know, people don't maybe think that I faked my degree, but I mean, I did take my degree, and you can see that this is an awful picture. If you look at my receding hairline, and my hair looks like a clown. He was very sort of like, he pretty much took the piss on himself, basically, in that post, essentially. And people loved it based on that. And that sort of mechanism was also how he sort of like used to attack PH a lot as well. This idea that he sort of like, as I wrote the article, he wears the shame as a shield as well, meaning that whenever any PH politician does certain things, and he would basically attack them and say that, oh, you sort of like made these claims that I did these things under my administration. Again, he never claims whether he did it or not. But at the same time, I'm seeing that you guys are doing the exact same thing that you claimed that I did that was bad. And so where is your shame? And so he sort of like reverts that and points it back at them. And a lot of politicians pretty much had no idea what to do with that, because if you're already in a very sort of like your shame level is so high, how much higher can you go? You can only do so much before people just be like, don't you have anything more sort of like more evidence to provide in that sense? So it was and I think that sort of like lays the groundwork for how is it that politicians now actually are very careful with how they present themselves, and has sort of shifted the way that we understand how shame works in this country. And again, that also has changed the way that sort of like this current government was formed as well. You know, during that period, you know, when the Hung Parliament was announced, there was all this like wheeling and dealing that was going on. And one of the things that I never thought I would see happen in Malaysian politics happened. You know, all these huge key political stalwarts coming up onto social media and whatever, and basically giving wholehearted apologies to whoever they felt they had aggrieved before, because they wanted to form a coalition. So you had people like you had Lim Guan Eng, people like sort of like the late Ramesh Rao, who all just came on and gave the most, you could see there was like a very heartfelt apology. I mean, it may not have been heartfelt in reality, but the way that they wrote out was insincere. There was no qualification. It was direct and to the point. They are sorry for what they did, and they want to move forward. So I think Malu Apa Bosku laid the foundation for that kind of approach, because otherwise, you'd probably still be at loggerheads. Nobody would want to sort of give any ground. And so that has sort of like laid the groundwork for this whole idea of a more compromising politician that we're seeing today.
So you see that as an effect of the Malu Apa Bosku campaign on the current Malaysian political landscape. That's quite interesting. I want to ask you, because you have done quite a lot of research on online influence operations in Malaysia, cyber troopers. The last time you were on the show, we were talking about cyber troopers and how they have disseminated information on or controlled narratives online in the Malaysian online digital space. Can we talk a little bit about Najib's role as a social media tactician? Him or the team behind it? I'm not sure who is behind it, but the use of emotion, almost demagogue-like, in the digital space. What are your takeaways of his legacy online?
Previously, I mean, Najib has really sort of like his campaign. I mean, while I may have a focused study on Malu Apa Bosku, his entire social media campaign was probably it's definitely, as you said, he's going to be his legacy. That's really, you know, we've seen a politician that pretty much disappeared completely from the public eye, but managed to sort of like conjure this image of himself that was of like, you know, he was the best technocrat, he was the most human politician in the country, and all of that worked to his benefit as well. And I think even today, you know, during even in GE15, you know, when various think tanks were running all their surveys on who should be prime minister, his name would still come up. It wouldn't be the top list, but the fact that it's still there, and even though he was behind bars at the point, speaks volumes of the sort of like the effect that he has in people's minds even today as a result of that. And yes, his team was very, very smart. And again, he was sort of like, you know, 2018 was probably his darkest point, in the sense, you know, he was fumbling around, he didn't really know what to do, and he was sort of just like trying to keep his get ahead of authorities who were sort of going after him. But in 2019 was everything sort of like came together, and that was when he sort of like switched his mode and really was sort of like, I'm going to really build an image on social media. Even there's all these talks about how, you know, politicians usually use social media as something that is seen as separate or something that they are forced to use because that's where the people are. So, I mean, today it's a very, very different situation. Many politicians do actually use social media very, very strongly as well. But even before that, a lot of times, you know, you can tell that, like, I think certain politicians who use social media very strongly, you can tell that, yes, they're working on it, and they may or may not have a very strong team that's helping them working with it. But there's often an issue of a lack of strategy, or rather a unified goal in what exactly they want to achieve by using this particular platform. And I think Najib sort of showed that you can actually have these specific goals, and you focus on sort of like chasing those goals properly, you can actually get them. And that's actually very, very effective, because previously everybody was sort of like, let's just try to get as many people to see us as possible, try to build the following and acting as though they're social influencers. But in actuality, they should actually be some there. Again, if you're a politician in Malaysia, you have significant social capital already. You know, social media shouldn't be seen as something that would just sort of like add on to, as something that's tacked on. You can actually incorporate it to build on that. And I think Najib was the one that sort of like demonstrated that that is how you do it.
All right. Thank you so much for speaking with me, Ben. That was Dr. Benjamin Low. He is the lead author of the recently published journal article, Shame and Shamelessness, Changing Discourses in Najib Razak's Social Media Campaigns. Ben, thanks so much for speaking with me. That wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night. We'll be right back.